Andre Debuse, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me, Virginia. I really like that phrase, the skids of the American dream.
Well, thank you. Well,
yeah, it's good writing.
Well, and it's one of the things that we do see quite a bit in your books. I'm thinking of a point in the book, in the story, The Bartender. He's kind of reviewing hard luck stories that he hears from waitresses. And I was curious about what makes you so interested and maybe such a canny observer of these down and out stories.
Well, you know, I grew up down and out, like a lot of us. You know, I was from a family that was a member of the educated working poor. And, you know, I grew up around a lot of people who were facing, you know, financial hardship and addictions and violence and jail terms. And it just kind of hardwired me to see the world that way. And, I, you know, frankly, it's made me a happier person because I don't expect life to be easy. I expect it to be hard. And when there are moments of grace, it's quite lovely.
Hmm.
But, you know, true, too, you know, there is no story without trouble. You know, the word we throw around a lot in, you know, creative writing classes, in English classes growing up, is conflict. I prefer the word trouble because that's all you need to get a story going, you know. You don't necessarily need all-out conflict, but you do need trouble. And the truth is, I think if you scratch the surface of any human being taking a breath right now as we speak, they're in some kind of trouble. That's just normal. That's just how it is.
And these troubles and the manifestations, the addiction, the violence, the jail terms, these cut across class lines and neighborhoods in these stories. In our first story, listen carefully as our options have changed, we meet Mark. Now, he's a project manager, very successful. He envisions his strong matrix falling apart. I'm interested in this idea of him trying to manage a relationship like a job or assuming that he can.
Well, you know, first of all, writers are horrible vultures, right? We hover over people's lives and take notes without even realizing we're doing it. You know, a good friend of mine's a project manager out on the West Coast, and I noticed that he was bringing his job home with him whenever I would visit. He was, you know, that job requires you to be controlling, and that's, you know, the strength of being that kind of person. But when you come home, you don't want to be controlling the people in the house too much, do you?
Mm-hmm.
And but I found that he was doing that with his wife, and so I was exploring that possibility, that thought of, well, what's it like when what you're rewarded for at work is a liability at home.
Hmm.
And those set of skills. And yeah, Mark Welch in that first story comes to find out that his wife, who was cheating on him, may have had her reasons.
We see a similar urge for control, at least in the bartender. He assumes, like Mark, that he can at least put the chaos in a manageable form. He acts out with this waitress Jackie. He thinks one last time, and then I'll quietly sort of pull out before the damage is done. So there's this faint hope that, as stupid as he's been, it will all be fixed one day. And it seems like you have you have a kind of sympathy for these characters that, you know, they're almost smothered by their own, I don't know, ineffectualism, but they hope that it will change. I'm curious about how you develop them.
One of my favorite lines from a Springsteen song is, "Everybody's got a hungry heart," you know, and we all do. And so the way I try to get into these characters is I have to withhold judgment. You know, I cannot judge these people at all. They won't show up. It's really kind of Ouija board weird, but it's the same thing that happens in life. If you judge someone in life, if you prejudge them, no one, they're going to feel it and know it. And what are they going to do? They're going to walk away from you if they have any sense of self. And that's true for characters, too. They'll walk away if they feel you judging. So they show up more when I find that if I step into the writing of characters with really authentic curiosity, where I'm not judging, I'm really just asking, what's it like to be you? They tend to start talking. They start to write themselves, and the story starts to happen on its own. And it's this wonderful trance-like state the writer gets into. And, you know, a lot of writers are afraid to talk about this out loud, but I will. Mm-hmm. It's really why I write, to get into that state when it takes off on its own.
So you can feel that. You can feel that distinct change.
Yeah, and you know, I, in writing classes and conferences and whatnot, I find myself putting it this way, that I think there's a difference between imagining something and making it up. Anybody can cobble together a story and make it up, and can be actually fun. But that's different from imagining it, where sometimes it just doesn't ring true. Often it doesn't ring true. And the thing that you don't even want to write about is the thing that rings true. And you have to go with that. And, you know, this just is my whole thought about this creative writing thing, is that I think when you're writing honestly and deeply and nakedly with true emotion, true authentic curiosity, you're descending into your dream world. And what you want to write about is irrelevant. You know, Blaise Pascal, the 16th century philosopher, inventor, said anything written to please the author is worthless. Which I kind of hate that line because it's so harsh, but I believe it's true. So, yeah, that's the fun of it. And the terror of it.
We're speaking with the National Book Award-winning author Andre Debuse. He's with us to talk about his new book, Dirty Love. Well, and I'd love to talk a little bit about how these characters that you set up and what shows up, many of them had these absent fathers or emotionally absent fathers. The men are mostly friendless, Mark nor Robert. They don't know who to call in a crisis. And they also wish that they had a cause. Both of them have this kind of sense of envy when they see the war memorial in town. You know, Mark thinks, well, maybe I am a coward. So it's interesting. We have the, you know, the image of the soldier. We have the image of the success story. Are we missing another model of manliness to follow?
Well, now you're in my little wheelhouse. You know, I try not to ever think about theme when I'm writing. I try not to say anything when I'm writing. But, you know, it's really interesting in hindsight to hear you talk about these stories in that way. For me, you know, I don't purposely make these characters not have male friends they can turn to in a crisis. I don't purposely make them hunger to be part of something larger. But I think that these characters coming out of my dream world represent my belief that so many men, especially of an older generation, which frankly right now is mine, grew up in a time where, you know, it wasn't cool, and it's still, to a large extent, it's not accepted to be intimate with other men emotionally because of this fear of being gay and all this other crap that men, boys have to put up with. And I think that is I'm simplifying too much, but it's very complicated. I think that while women and girls have a horrible anvil on them in other ways, the anvil that boys have on them is that they've got to be winners. They've got to come ahead. They've got to be the alpha male in the room. And this isolates them, and I think sends so many men down paths of doing things in their lives that they wouldn't otherwise do, just to get rewards that are hollow in the end, empty, and leaving them, you know, like Mark Welch, you know, financially successful in his career, but absolutely isolated spiritually, emotionally, and frankly, in his heart.
We do have another character, however, the lovely, gentle Uncle Francis. Now, he did fight in Korea and spent years drinking to try and forget about the experience. Still has his own baggage, certainly. But he gives us a sense of time passing, even in the way he observes things. One thing I was struck by is, you know, he's driving through his tawdry little town and notices the boarded up Woolworths, which is in so many New England towns, in this generation listening to rap. And he thinks they all look like convicts now. You know, they're all tattooed and pierced. And he is a man who it seems like is trying to let go of those judgments, both external and internal. Tell us a little bit about discovering Francis for you.
Yeah, I can hear your affection for him in your voice, and I feel the same way. I had finished the three earlier, the three other stories first, and I had submitted the book. I thought the book was done with those three, and my editor said, no, I think there's got to be one more. And as soon as she said it, I began to sense and feel an old man. And I've never written from the point of view of an old man. And I also sensed the presence of a young girl. They're really just kind of shadowy, but I hung up as quickly as I could for my editor, and I began to just kind of stare at the page. You know, Flannery O'Connor says, there's a certain grain of stupidity the writer can hardly do without, and that is the quality of having to stare. And very quickly I saw Francis, 81 years old, tending the flowers of his dead wife. And I was kind of off and running. And then somewhere in there was his 18-year-old niece living with him, a great niece. Mm-hmm. And I knew I had something to work with there.
The characters throughout these stories walk in and out of each other's lives. You know, Mark and his wife were regulars at the Whaler. That's where Robert tends bar. Devin busses tables there. She thinks Robert is a creep, by the way. Marla works at the bank with the man who had an affair with Mark's wife. So how important was it, were these connections while piecing together the stories?
Well, let me tell you quite honestly, I wasn't aware of the connections till my editor pointed them out.
Huh. Must have been that dream life again.
It's a dream life. Seriously. She said, are you aware that they're working in the same bank and these two work in the same restaurant and you've got them both in the same beach area? And then I realized that it was happening on its own. You know, what I love about writing is everything. But I think what I love most about it is how it feels when you're writing well, that you're excavating something, that you're slowly digging and brushing off artifacts, and then they come to life. You think you might have an urn on your hands, and before you know it, it's the top of a building. Before you know it, you realize you have a city. And, you know, that's what happened when I saw the connection between those stories, and I simply allowed it, and it was... It's kind of enjoyable that it was happening organically without... I wasn't trying to write a book of linked stories. They just kind of appeared.
Mm. For me, you know, as a reader, thinking that these people that pass by our lives, the bank clerk, the woman who's bussing our table at the restaurant, the man, you know, leaning over in a garden, they all have their, as you put it, trouble.
Well, see, no, that's really why I was so happy to have these connections pointed out to me. But my editor is that... It bolsters my belief that every life is sacred. I'm sure you and your listeners have had this experience where you make eye contact with someone at the airport, someone who smiles at you really warmly, and you see the glint of intelligence and life in their eyes, and you have about a half-second connection between you two, just making contact. And as you walk away, you know you will never see him or her ever again the rest of your lives. And to me, that's just remarkably poignant and beautiful, and it makes me, I always wonder what's going to happen to that man or woman, you know, and you know, what's going to happen to me? And, you know, what I love about the whole idea of trying to write character-driven fiction and reading character-driven fiction is that it pulls you into the heart of another. And, if you know, frankly, I think the deeper we go, there is no other. So I do like that the stories are linked very loosely in that way. For that reason.
Well, Andre Dubuis, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much for your time today.
I thank you, and thank you for reading that book.
Andre Dubuis III's most recent book is called Dirty Love. He's going to be reading from it and signing books at New England College on Wednesday, April the 16th. You'll find more information on the book and the event at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for another genre of books that comes from fertile imaginations. We'll hear a case for taking illustrated children's books much more seriously when Word of Mouth returns.